Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Terry Rockefeller of the group Peaceful Tomorrows, who discusses her recent visit to Iraq with other U.S. citizens who lost family members during the September 11th terrorist attacks. Steve Elner, professor of history in Caracas, who takes a look at the sputtering general strike organized by opponents of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. And Soren Ambrose of the 50 Years is Enough Network, who reports from the third annual World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, where an estimated 100,000 progressive activists and academics from around the globe met to envision and work for a more just world. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During the massive demonstrations against the July 2001 G8 summit in Genoa, Italy, security officials planted key evidence to justify a bloody raid on a dormitory used by protesters. According to the BBC and several Italian newspapers, a senior police officer, Pietro Troini, planted two petrol bombs on the site to justify the raid. Over 93 activists were arrested during the raid in the early hours of July 22, 2001. 72 suffered injuries and were later released without charges. Currently, there are 77 police officers under investigation for alleged brutality, and three police chiefs have been removed from their jobs. Despite the furor in Europe, few major American media outlets or wire service has reported on the charges of planted evidence by the Italian police. According to the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the American mainstream media is used to blaming activists for the violence during anti-globalization protests. During the G8 summit, which saw one protester, Carlo Giuliani, killed by police, the media had little interest in investigating the police response to dissent, which included the use of live ammunition. Thanks to the 1996 Federal Communications Act, passed in the Clinton years, 10 corporations now dominate U.S. radio. Clear Channel and Viacom specifically control 42% of listeners and 45% of industry revenues, and jumped from owning 40 radio stations to 1,240, 30 times more than allowed by previous congressional regulation. Before deregulation, radio was the last bastion of media diversity. Now the Federal Communications Commission, under Republican Chairman Michael Powell, wants to deregulate media even further. With little media attention paid to proposed new reforms, public comment has been kept to a minimum, and by the end of January, the changes are expected to pass. Jonathan Adelstein, one of two Democrats on the five-member commission, told the Associated Press, quote, "Any changes the FCC makes to its media ownership rules could massively and irreversibly change the media landscape, and it must proceed very cautiously." Contrary to Powell's comment that shared ownership leads to diversity because stations would not want to compete against themselves owning multiple rock, country, or top 40 stations, The Nation magazine found 561 cases of format redundancy across the country. Programming for local radio stations is being produced at the national level by media conglomerates rather than at the local level by hometown disc jockeys. Where hometown bands once broke into public attention through local stations, many local stations no longer have a local DJ at all. The changes would allow mergers between television networks like NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox, and allow one company to own a major daily newspaper, a major television, and radio station in the same community. While groups like the Future of Music Coalition are fighting the changes, Michael Powell stated on July 16th that, quote, "Unless we can re-justify each broadcast ownership rule under current market conditions, the rule goes away." The public is invited to comment on proposed media ownership deregulation at www.fcc.gov. Despite Argentina's economic collapse, a textile factory in Buenos Aires managed to keep churning out expensive suits. For over a year, blue-collar seamstresses and tailors have run the business after the owners abandoned the factory in the wake of Argentina's economic crisis. Seamstress Matilda Adorno told the New Internationalist magazine, quote, "If we had not taken over the factory then, the bosses would have closed it." So far, the Berkman family, who owns the factory, has not returned to reclaim it, and the workers continue to pay everyone the same wage after covering overhead expenses. The factory is now an icon of the powerful opposition movement that grew in Argentina over the last year. The idea of worker control has spread to other factories, including the Zanin Ceramics factory that has doubled worker wages despite eviction orders. Still, there are some troubles ahead for workers. Last spring, 100 policemen stormed the Berkman factory looking for criminals and activists. All they found were three workers and a baby. In response, neighbors organized a huge protest against the raid. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
The January 27th interim report by United Nations co-chief weapons inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei on their 2 months of work in Iraq begged more questions than it answered. While the UN team noted general cooperation by Iraqi officials in gaining access to requested sites, criticism was aimed at Baghdad's lack of detail in accounting for 6,500 chemical bombs, VX nerve agent, and anthrax, citing the fact that no evidence has yet been found indicating Iraq now possesses or is making weapons of mass destruction. France, Russia, China, and Germany asked for more time to continue inspections. The Bush administration greeted the UN report with bellicose statements and irritation at resistance to their war plans. But while the Pentagon continued to pour planes, ships, and troops into the Persian Gulf region, four members of a group called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows journeyed to Iraq earlier this month. There, they witnessed firsthand the impact of the 1991 conflict, 12 years of sanctions, and the very real prospect of a new war is having on the people of Iraq. Peaceful Tomorrows is a group made up of family members of people killed during the September 11th terrorist attacks and seeks nonviolent alternatives to war. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Terry Rockefeller, whose sister Laura was killed at the World Trade Center in New York City. Rockefeller, a documentary filmmaker from Arlington, Massachusetts, talks about the people she met in the cities of Baghdad and Basra, Iraq's preparations for war, and her hope for peace.
We had planned visits that had been set up in part through Voices in the Wilderness and in part were things that the government clearly wanted us to do. We were taken to hospitals and schools and to visit families who had lost people themselves during the conflict. In Basra, we met with a family whose father, the father had been killed just this past December 1st. In a missile strike in the no-fly zone. And then we met with the family of a young woman who had been injured in the same missile strike. But we also, you know, went to family homes that people, you know, who clearly wanted to have Americans visit them and just and speak with them. And we went to the university in Baghdad where we spoke not only with a fair number of students, but we had a very congenial, sort of almost hour-and-a-half-long meeting with three faculty members.
And what did they tell you about, not so much, I guess, about the past, but about what's going on there right now?
Well, overwhelmingly, people would say, we're so glad you're here. We're glad to know that there are Americans that are for peace, but we don't understand your government, and you need to know how angry we are. You need to know. And it is interesting that people brought up the past often. They had a very keen memory of a time in the 1980s when Iraq and the United States had been allies. And they expressed real frustration at the notion that there weren't diplomatic relationships, that they felt that America didn't want to talk to them. And here's where, you know, I always had to say, well, of course, people have government minders. There are government minders present. People are going to say what they need to say, but they were always saying, this country is cooperating with the weapons inspection, this country doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, and we don't understand why there's a crisis. Then, almost in the next breath, they would say, but if there's a war, we're going to fight. and we will not be subjugated.
That was actually what I wanted to ask you. I've heard some reports from people on the ground in Iraq say that since the United States has become so threatening war at every turn and sending actually lots of troops and war material and, you know, military equipment and so on.
And that's daily reported in the press. People are very aware of that.
A lot of times, sort of human nature, I think, to sort of rally around when somebody's threatened, and if Iraq feels itself threatened, how much support do you feel there is for the government and for Saddam Hussein if the U.S. attacks?
You know, I feel because of the presence of government minders, whenever our delegation was talking to people, I always have to question what I was told and question whether people are absolutely speaking what they feel in their hearts. But what we were always told was, we are prepared to fight. We do not believe we will lose. We may suffer defeat, but we will not be defeated as a nation. There was an extraordinary, and this I did really believe, sense of national identity. There was an extraordinary sense of history that went very clearly, you know, back to memories of British control and then becoming a nation, but also there was a 5,000-year sense of history of being, you know, the Fertile Crescent, the Tigris and Euphrates River, the place where civilization, you know, began to evolve in such amazing ways.
Did you get a sense from your experience there that war can be averted?
I went because I'm trying to be hopeful that war can be averted. I feel that at this point, I feel a great frustration as an American that despite what I read, you know, about in terms of rapidly shifting American public opinion, Americans questioning the way in which the war might be conducted, I feel like our administration is determined to have this war. However, you know, when I was in Iraq, I was incredibly aware that we were only one of what the press, while we were there, the Iraqi press, said were 32 different international delegations that had come. I personally met people from South Africa, Germany, and Japan while I was there. I know there were other delegations, so there is an incredible international opposition to this war, certainly an international opposition to a unilaterally conducted American-led war. And I still hold out hope that there may be regional diplomacy that goes on in the Middle East that can make a difference, and that the American public opinion can be turned around if, in fact, you know, some of our very important allies, like France, you know, continue to say this is not yet the time, this is not the right time to fight a war.
That was Terry Rockefeller of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Contact the group by calling area code 415-518-1991 or visit their website at www.peacefultomorrows.org. The general strike organized by opponents of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, now entering its eighth week, has been crumbling. Although the South American nation's economy has lost hundreds of millions of dollars, primarily due to a work stoppage which paralyzed the state oil industry, backing for the strike and its leaders has withered. In a recent show of support for the embattled populist president, hundreds of thousands of mostly poor Venezuelans took to the streets to demonstrate their backing for the Constitution and Chavez, who has been twice democratically elected. But increasing class and racial polarization in Venezuelan society continues to breed tension that often erupts in violence. Recent efforts by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and the Organization of American States to broker a deal between Chavez and his opponents have thus far failed to produce results. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Elner, professor of history at the Universidad de Oriente in Caracas, who takes a look at the sputtering general strike and the political resilience of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
The strike began on December 2nd, and a week or so after the strike began, there was a shutdown of the oil industry. And Venezuelan oil production reached a very small percentage of its normal output. And gradually, the government succeeded in operating the industry. The strike apparently was a strike of the upper echelons of the industry. And the Chavez government hired people who had experience in the industry, brought in people from other countries, and slowly the production has recovered. At this point, the strike effort is really petering out, and probably the strike will be called off by the opposition within a week or so.
It's quite certain that the general strike against Hugo Chavez has had a dramatic effect on the Venezuelan economy. But what is the effect on popular opinion of Hugo Chavez and those who want to bring down his presidency?
You know, from what I've read in surveys that have been referred to, Chavez has actually benefited, politically speaking. And I say that because, you know, the strike has failed. And many people who were either in the anti-Chavez camp or people who were in an in-between position, and I think about 40%, and this is what I estimate, about 40% of the population, is critical of Chavez, but even more critical of the opposition. And those people, a certain percentage of those people, are now moving over to a less critical position of Chavez. The fact that Chavez was able to weather this situation, and the fact that the opposition promised their people that Chavez would be out by Christmas, they emphasized that when the strike began on December 2nd, has discredited the opposition to a certain extent. It's also radicalized the opposition. It's radicalized people in the Chavez camp. On Thursday of last week, Chavez called an immense demonstration. I mean, it's anybody's guess as to how many, you know, in the hundreds of thousands. And just watching the images on the screen, it's evident that both the opposition has great mobilization capacity and Chavez does also.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter was recently in Venezuela to attempt to negotiate an agreement of some kind. And the Organization of American States has similarly tried to broker a deal. Is there anything in the air that they've been able to hammer anything of substance out between the two sides?
One of the things that President Carter called for, on the one hand, he accepted as one option Chavez's position, which is elections or referendum, a recall referendum in August, because Chavez states that this is what the Constitution allows for. Chavez has been unwilling to accept elections before that date because he says that there's nothing in the Constitution that allows for that. And basically what President Carter has called for is an agreement in which Chavez, you know, agrees to accepting a recall referendum in August, and also rehiring all the oil people who went on strike. And his first proposition was you know, basically accepted by Chavez. Chavez says that he'd be willing to participate in this recall referendum in August, but he is unwilling to rehire at least the executives who planned, who engineered the oil strike. So there still is a considerable distance between Gaviria and Carter on the one hand and Chavez and the opposition on the other.
If indeed a referendum on Chavez's rule is held in August per the Constitution of Venezuela, is Chavez likely to survive that ballot?
You know, according to the polls, Chavez still is the most popular politician. The polls indicate that Chavez has between 30-35%. And this figure is actually from before the strike. Chavez has actually gained support. According to one survey that I saw that was published in the newspaper, it's a weekly newspaper, it's called Quinto Día, his support is up to about 50%. I mean, that's just one survey that was quoted in the press, and it's not a pro-Chavez newspaper. But in any case, you know, the surveys that were conducted before the strike placed Chavez at between 30-35%, and the leading politicians of the opposition somewhere around 20, you know, a little over 20%, and then the second leading candidate of the opposition less than that. You know, it really depends on whether the opposition can unite. And I even more than that, the opposition has, I think, in my mind, been discredited because it hasn't presented a program to the country. Its only demand is the ousting of Chavez. And I think that really the results of those elections in August will depend on the opposition's candidate, the unity of the opposition, and its program.
That was Steve Elner, professor of history in Caracas. He is the co-editor of Venezuelan Politics in the Chavez Era, Class Polarization and Conflict, released by Lynn Reiner Publishers. For the third year running, Porto Alegre, Brazil, has been a magnet for social justice activists from around the globe who converged there in late January for the World Social Forum. Originally conceived as a venue to counter the elite World Economic Forum held annually in Davos, Switzerland, where business and political leaders gather to formulate free trade and neoliberal policies, the World Social Forum has in many ways eclipsed its rival. An estimated 100,000 activists, academics, workers, and students representing diverse social justice movements participated this year in hundreds of workshops and plenary sessions to explore alternative models for equitable, economic, and environmentally sustainable development. The recent election of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva as Brazil's first leftist president cast this year's social forum as a celebration as much as a progressive summit. Although some controversy was generated by Lula's decision to visit the elite gathering in Davos after giving an address in Porto Alegre. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Soren Ambrose, a policy analyst with the 50 Years is Enough Network, who reports from Porto Alegre on the deliberations at this year's social forum on issues ranging from President Bush's drive for war with Iraq to organizing opposition to the proposed hemisphere-wide free trade area of the Americas.
This was the third World Social Forum, and since its beginning, when we had about 15,000 people gather in Porto Alegre, Brazil, it has stayed in Porto Alegre the following 2 years, and the crowds have grown to about 70,000 last year and this year. Although we haven't heard any official crowd estimates, I think it would be very surprising if there were fewer than 100,000 here. As it has grown, the dynamism of the ideas that are being discussed, the range of people from around the world and the range of countries are represented has grown proportionally. And by this point, I think the World Economic Forum has receded in interest, at least as compared to the World Social Forum, so that we no longer really need to think of the World Social Forum as a counterpoint to another event, but rather as the event that happens on an annual basis to discuss the ways of changing the world rather than the corporate executives and politicians who get together in Switzerland to talk about how to further the current world order in Davos. And I think this is also pointed out by the fact that since the beginning of the World Social Forum in 2001, the people who have been meeting in Davos have been relegated to largely responding to the charges of greed and trying to control the world for the elites, which should have been obvious all along, but have been put into stark counterpoint by the existence of the World Social Forum.
In discussing the World Social Forum and the movements that have grown globally to counter neoliberal economic policy and corporate-led globalization, is there a better way to define what's happening in Porto Alegre, where all those people are gathering? Is there one sort of set of ideas or umbrella of ideas that you could sort of define this movement by, or is it just too amorphous? Take a crack at that, if you would.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I wish it were easier to define. I think it is certainly the case that there are a few rallying points that are undeniable. This year, as you might expect, the common rallying point is opposition to Bush's war in Iraq, and in fact, opposition to the whole range of Bush's policies. But over and above everything has hovered the threat of this war. So that has certainly been a unifying influence, but it's also true to say that the anti-corporate globalization aspect that first was identified with the World Social Forum continues to be a rallying point. And here we have the whole panoply of issues from human rights to women's rights to labor rights to environmental preservation to sustainable food production. I mean, there are so many things to take into consideration here, and I'm unaware of anyone who has yet managed to fold it all into one agenda that even plausibly could be accepted as a universal agenda, though I do think that we are much closer to that time than we were when the World Social Forum was still just a concept.
What, if anything, came out of the World Social Forum this year that would guide the movements that will be opposing the free trade area of the Americas? Was there a lot of networking and organizing concretely about what happens next with that battle where George W. Bush will be pushing ratification of the FTAA in the coming year or two?
It was probably the single most discussed topic with the possible probable exception of the war. I don't know that a single strategy necessarily emerged. I don't think there was really that much controversy about it. Instead, the question for people is whether the new president of Brazil, Lula, the first Workers' Party candidate to be elected to that office here, is going to remain as fervent an opponent of the free trade of the Americas and the free trade agenda as he has seemed to be over the years. So I think that people are feeling quite confident, but also recognizing that our work is by no means over just because Lula was elected president of Brazil, but that working with him and in confidence that regardless of some of his diplomatic phrasings, he is on our side, we will be able to hold off the free trade area of the Americas. What we have to work on, of course, is the Central America Free Trade Act, and the Chilean agreement is already in place with the United States, but we have to resist these kind of bite-sized pieces that the U.S. has been pushing in lieu of the passage of the FTAA. That means opposing bilateral trade agreements with some governments and the Central American agreement. So I think people are feeling pretty energized and pretty optimistic, and I think feeling more optimistic than they could reasonably have done last year when it was still in doubt as to what the Brazilian election would provide. So, yeah, we're set for some work, but we're set to win, too.
That was Soren Ambrose of the 50 Years is Enough Network. Contact the network by calling area code 202-IMF-BANK or visit their website at www.50years.org. The World Social Forum website can be accessed at www.worldsocialforum.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Talk. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.